the something inside that we need so much. The sight of a touch or the scent of a sound or the strength of an oak we use deep in the ground. The wonder of flowers to be covered and then to burst up through tarmac to the sun again. Or to fly to the sun without burning a wing. To lie in a meadow and hear the grass sing. To have all these things in our memories hoard and they use them.
Wanna take a ride? To talk with Art Bell, call the Wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll free 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
It is. Coming up in a moment, Peter Ward. He's a professor of biology, a professor of Earth and Space Sciences, and adjunct professor of astronomy at the University of Washington in Seattle. Pretty heavy stuff, folks. He is a principal investigator of the University of Washington node of the NASA Astrobiology Institute that involves the leadership of over 25 scientists. 25 studying the possibility of finding life beyond our Earth. He has published more than 100 scientific papers dealing with paleontological, zoological, and astronomical topics in addition. He has published 12 books and has appeared in numerous television documentaries. He's senior counselor of the Paleontological Society, was awarded an affiliate professorship at the California Institute of Technology. Well, very well qualified to comment on the possibility of finding life elsewhere. Do you think there is life elsewhere? Or perhaps the question ought to be, will it find us? We will ask in a moment. Peter, welcome to the show.
Hey, Art, how are you?
I'm great. Where are you located, Peter?
I'm in Seattle, Washington right now.
Seattle. Then this is great timing for this newsflash. My God, you're going to want to hear this. SETI just announced they have made contact with an alien race.
Which aliens are those?
Huh. Well, so much for that. No, folks, it's a ruse. I wanted to see how Peter Ward would react. You did very well, Peter. He just chuckled. Which ones would those be?
Yeah, I know those.
So
guys,
you know, well. So that kind of I don't know. That kind of tells me something. I'm trying to figure out what. I just thought I'd use you as a test case and see what you said.
Well,
you laughed. You laughed, Peter.
I guess I'd be delighted.
Well, would you really?
Yeah, I would actually. I'd like everybody else. It'd be great. But about a week later, would anything be different?
Well, I don't know. I guess that would have to do with the nature of the contact.
I guess so.
Mm-hmm. You really don't think it's going to happen, though. I mean, that laugh told me you just flat didn't believe it, period. So so you don't expect it, do you?
I don't. And the dirty little secret is that SETI has already searched a huge area of our galaxy and found nothing. And yet SETI... You realize SETI has to sound very hopeful and optimistic or they can't get donors, because without donors, they have a huge overhead. And so they have to play the double game of sounding as optimistic as hell, but on the other hand, not really telling anybody that they're searching like crazy and can't find anything.
Well, there was the wow signal. No, nobody's ever explained that. I mean, come on, Peter. We only transmitted, I think, now, what, once or twice from Earth?
Well, we've been, look at the movie Contact. We've been transmitting.
Yeah, I know. I love Lucy and everything, but that's scattered stuff. With actual intent to contact somebody, we only, I think, did that one time, right? Using Arecibo, really a big signal intended for contact.
Well, let's hope that they try more. I mean, I'm all in favor of trying it because it's relatively cheap compared to everything else we spend on this planet.
But all that means you'll be sending in a donation.
I doubt it.
Probably not, huh?
Probably not.
All right, everybody should know Peter has written a book called Rare Earth, Why Complex Life is Uncommon in the Universe. And, in fact, so uncommon that Peter doesn't think there, probably doesn't think there is other intelligent life, right?
No, I think we're really taken to task for that, and that's not what we said. I think, I personally believe the universe is so large, there'll be lots of other intelligent life, but it's going to be so rare and so scattered that the distances will probably make any alien finding any other alien highly unlikely.
Hmm. But if there is other intelligent life, it, like us, is going to be trying to contact others at some point in its development, wouldn't you think?
I would think so, unless, of course, it's an underwater intelligence. And the problem with being underwater is there's no electronics.
Yeah.
And therefore, you would have no way of sending radio beams or picking them up and have, therefore, no appreciation of anything else out there.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about extinction. What is the so-called great dying?
Well, really, it ties right back into this whole idea of life in space. I began my work and my career looking at mass extinctions, and I started my work looking at what killed the dinosaurs, which was certainly an asteroid, and then went back to an even bigger extinction 250 million years ago. About 90% of all species die out. So if the dinosaurs died in fire and brimstone from an asteroid, surely a bigger extinction was just a bigger asteroid, and many of us in this business went out expecting that, and to our surprise, could find no evidence of asteroid collision at all in the rocks of that age.
Hmm.
So other explanations had to be sought for. And to give it the sort of the life in space bent, the great dying was as close as our planet has come to the extinction of all life. I mean, we really had a terrible, terrible depression of the diversity on planet Earth. And once you start asking...
When was that?
This, again, a quarter billion years ago, 250 million years ago, 90% of all species on the planet Earth die off.
Why?
Well, isn't that the great question? It turns out the short answer, it appears to have been global warming.
Global warming.
Climate change.
Yeah.
Come on, you've written about this.
I do know something about it.
You do, and the last time I was on your show was right before... The wonderful movie, The Day After Tomorrow, came out because
yes.
I got in the script, and we had a wonderful 3 hours chuckling over that little deal.
Yes, it really caused quite a stir, you know.
Not enough of one, though. That's the thing. The movie sort of came and went, and I was hoping...
I know, the movie came and went, but the everyday headlines, they keep on trucking.
They do.
And there have been some amazing... I mean, look at Kilimanjaro, buddy, since we last talked. It's pretty near got a bare butt up there.
Yeah, it does. It does, and I'm looking at the Cascade Mountains right now.
15 years ahead of when they said it should happen.
Well, we have no skiing in Washington State. They shut it down months and months ago. It's just there was no snow this year.
Well, you know why?
I've called global warming myself.
Well, it's because the jet stream has brought all of it right down and deposited it around me. I'm about 20 miles from Death Valley.
Oh, yeah, you got all the wildflowers, right?
Hey, baby, it's turning green. It's like a golf course out there on the desert. And
well, you should get more tourists then.
Yeah, if this keeps up, we're going to plant redwoods and we're going to start a different industry here. So, yeah, that's why you're in a drought in that part of the world right now. And we're drowning. In fact, we've got more rain coming Tuesday and Wednesday. This is just ridiculous. We're over our yearly total. We were over our yearly totals before the year had hardly begun.
Well, is it a good thing or a bad thing for you, Art? If you could do it over again, would you have all this rain again or give it up?
I'm not sure. That's a really interesting question. It really is. I'm not sure yet of the answer. I like the desert as a desert, and I'm not sure that I'll be all that comfortable to see it change if that is, in fact, what's underway.
Well, if you like a lot more people, if you have more rain, you're certainly going to get them.
Yeah.
I can imagine you don't really want that.
This area is growing incredibly. The land values are just shooting up around here. It's crazy what's going on in southern Nevada right now, and particularly in Pahrump. It's amazing. And anyway, you say this last mass extinction was due to global warming. Well, there certainly were no factories that we were aware of, nor automobiles or anything else from man contributing to what occurred a quarter billion years ago. Right?
Yeah, but there was something that was making carbon dioxide just in almost the same fashion that we do. It wasn't internal combustion engines. It was the biggest volcanic events of the history of the planet.
Remember to stay close to that phone for me. The biggest volcanic event, so which one? Do you know offhand?
Yeah, about one quarter of Siberia is covered with lava, and it came out of a number of very large fissures a quarter billion years ago, and the extrusion of all that lava created an enormous amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. The planet warmed probably 10 degrees centigrade, or about 15, 16 degrees Fahrenheit, and with all that warming, there was a, at the same time, a drop in oxygen. So we got hotter and we had less oxygen of the two combined to create...
Out of curiosity, do scientists know, do you know how much oxygen left the atmosphere?
Well, it went from 21% today to about 11%.
How serious...
The atmosphere was gone.
Got it. How serious would that be for human beings?
It would put us right now at 17,000 feet.
Where, and
sea level would be now 17,000 feet.
17,000 feet. Well, that would take care of some percentage of the population right away.
I've been at 14,000. It's really hard.
Yes. Yes. It would necessitate, I suppose, artificial atmospheres for comfort, right?
Certainly you could not do any sort of cerebral work. I've tried to do an interview at 14,000. It just didn't work.
Didn't work.
And secondly, any sort of... physical activity is almost impossible.
So that would be indeed quite catastrophic. I was having a little talk with Whitley Strieber last night, and he had a concern since we wrote a global superstorm that became Day After Tomorrow. He's got a new concern involving methane, and I wonder if you share that concern. His concern is that it's trapped in the ground beneath the oceans, and it's increasing, and that there's some possibility that this methane would suddenly let go.
Yeah, there's a huge concern about this.
Oh, there is. Oh,
huge.
So this is grounded well scientifically.
Yeah, very much so. There's an enormous quantity of methane frozen in sediment, and as we warm the world, say global warming creates Arctic conditions, as you know, to get warmer. All it has to do is warm up a slight amount, and the methane that's trapped in sediment in the Arctic goes into the atmosphere. Well, methane is an even better greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide.
Really?
So in 20 years, methane converts to CO2. It goes from CH4 to CO2. It takes up oxygen when it does this and makes the world warmer yet. So methane's on everybody's, all the climate scientists are very concerned about methane, and we also have evidence that was there in this great dying of a quarter billion years ago. We have a very strong methane signature that we're seeing in sediments.
Peter, what could trigger a methane release? How can we imagine that might occur?
The scariest scenario comes from a guy at Northwestern, a chemical engineer named Gregory Ryskin, and he's written two papers. The scientific publications, the normal Main Street scientific publications, wouldn't publish them. Although I thought they were pretty good science, I saw them at pre-publication, said this ought to be published. He has suggested that there's enough methane in the Black Sea that could come out of solution as a big bubble.
Right.
And his point is, if it comes out as a bubble and then it's struck by lightning, methane, of course, is natural gas, it explodes in the atmosphere. And so he had a sort of tongue-in-cheek, but maybe not, saying that he could envision China disappearing in an instant.
That'd be like a fuel air bomb.
Yes.
Times many. Oh, yeah. My God.
Yeah, it's exciting.
Exciting. There are so many perils, potential perils for us. With regard to this methane business, is it the kind of thing that is triggered suddenly? And if so, do you have any idea the dynamics behind such a trigger?
Yeah, we have a pretty good model, actually. It happened. It was one of the most horrific accidents to befall mankind about 20 years ago. There was a small lake in Cameroon in Africa.
Ah, yes.
Called Lake Nyos. And Lake Nyos is volcanic, and it has sediment at the bottom. And the sediment at the bottom trapped an enormous volume of carbon dioxide. So it was held down at the bottom of the lake. And there was a temperature inversion of some sort that caused the bottom of the lake to come to the surface. So it's simply a turning over of the water column.
Huh.
And in one night, the CO2 came out as a big bubble. Well, it flowed in a semi-liquid form along the sides of the shoreline, and within 2 hours, 2,500 people and 10,000 cattle were dead.
I remember.
It was a terrible deal. And methane has the same characteristics and the same sort of oceanography. So the fear is that the Black Sea, if it were to start burping methane bubbles, these could ignite, unlike CO2, which is not flammable. Methane is.
Huh.
And so the physics would have CO2 coming out as well as methane coming out. And indeed, there's a scientific team at Harvard that suggests that the Great Dying was caused by bubbles of CO2 coming out and causing the global warming.
All right. So there's some reason to believe this could happen again, and even if it was not ignited by lightning, really, truly a worst-case scenario, still a gigantic release worldwide could certainly cause a chemical change in our atmosphere that might not be real good for us?
Well, certainly even the global warming aspects of it would be so catastrophic. You know, we hang by our fingernails in crop production. On this planet, we absolutely depend on every single farm region producing enormous bumper crops every year. I mean, that's what keeps us going.
Right.
If we have a methane explosion or a methane change of climate, what you see very quickly now is change in crop yield.
Huh.
I mean, we're seeing it right now. Washington State is looking at this drought, and we're going to have a tremendous reduction. You guys, with all that rain, doesn't do any good in the desert. I mean, nobody's growing crops down in southern Arizona and Nevada.
Not yet.
Well, they may, but they're not ready online. But our state, we're in deep trouble here.
Peter, I look around the world, and I read all these stories and read them to my listeners, and to me it seems as though the process is accelerating. You know, a Kilimanjaro thing, just the latest of a long, long string of stories. I mean, go talk to the Eskimos. Boy, is that scary stuff. What's going on up in Alaska? With the rate of acceleration of all of this, do you want to make any scientific guesses, Peter, about where we're headed and how soon we might get there?
Well, I just parrot what I've heard from our best climate modeler at the University of Washington. He's a guy named David Battisti. And he does the mathematical modeling of what happens to atmospheres as you warm them. And he's an expert at world climate models. So he's a guy who's really looking forward, and he uses the computer models to predict in the future, using
yes.
past data in the past.
Yes.
And his bottom line is that we will have 1,000 parts per million carbon dioxide in the atmosphere in 100 to 150 years.
Huh.
We have 360 right now, going to 380. But the point is that the last time we had 1,000 ppm was the Eocene epoch. This was right after the Age of Dinosaurs. The entire world was a jungle. I mean, this was a world that was absolutely jungle from pole to pole.
Huh.
We had crocodiles and palm trees in Washington State at that time. We have plenty of fossils of them. I take my kids up, and they go, wow, Hawaii and Washington. Well, Seattle hasn't had a good palm tree in 60 million years. But we'll have them in 100 years if this guy is correct.
In 100 years.
100 years. We're looking at a world warm enough that Washington State has palm trees and crocodiles. And I don't mind palm trees and crocodiles, but here's what I really mind. I don't want malaria, dengue fever, Ebola, and all the other goodies that the tropics have. That's the whirlwind that we reap.
Yes. And in 100 years, let's move north a little bit into Canada and the Yukon and Alaska. What's that going to look like? In 100 years.
Well, you certainly have no glaciers. You're going to find a very rapid change in vegetation. I mean, those places have really scrub spruce, and they have Sitka spruce. They've got all these trees that are really adapted to cold and to dry, because so many of the Yukon, those areas are very dry, of course. They get snow, but it's not a lot of rainfall. Rainfall patterns change. It gets warmer and wetter, and probably you start getting cedar and Douglas fir up there, so you're going to have a change of our vegetation sort of in the Washington State region way up north. But the bad news is that high CO2 has been found to work really badly with our crops. Corn and wheat reduce their yields in higher CO2. That's bad news.
How much of a factor do you think that man's presence is in worsening the situation that's underway anyway?
Well, that's a question I get all the time. I mean, people say, well, you know, you have this extinction of 250 million years ago, and you say that volcanic activity caused it. Well, there's no humans back 250 million years ago, so what?
Right.
But the point is that the volcanoes are still doing their thing today, and they have been forever.
Right.
So we have all this natural CO2 coming from the volcanoes. So it's not as if we're putting out the majority of CO2. It's just our SUVs and our industries putting enough extra out there.
So are we a factor? Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Or no? Yeah. Oh, yes, you
totally.
Said. Totally, huh? All right. Hold it right there. We're at the bottom of the hour. My guest is Peter Ward. He's a scientist. Make no mistake about that. And I'll refresh your knowledge of his knowledge as we move through the show, but he's a very serious scientist talking about the possibility of, well, I was going to say alien life, but maybe what we're talking about right now is the possibility of our lives perhaps being suspect. I'm Art Bell.
With Art Bell, call the Wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call Art at 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art Bell by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
Nothing but a heartache is right, man. If it's not one thing, it's another. Now it's methane, and the Earth has one giant gaseous moment, and that's it for us. Huh, let me count the ways. We'll be right back. For all the humor I'm probably trying to inject into this, Peter Ward is a very serious scientist. What we're talking about is a very serious possibility for the world. You know, Peter, I've seen, like I'm sure you have, a lot of these futuristic science fiction movies where, they start out with people living in these sort of environmental bubbles, and when they're out on the street, which is sort of foggy and misty and all full of some kind of gaseous mess, they're wearing masks and so forth to be even out in the street. And that's the kind of world we have on our hands. Is that the kind of thing that you're talking about here? Is that a possible future for our world, a world where, well, I don't know, we can just barely exist?
No, I don't think so, Art. I think you and I both understand that the doomsayers, the really, really negative views that are out there are, more often than not, they've been put out to sell things. I think a far more realistic view of it is that the world does get much warmer. And you, as I am sure, have spent some time in the tropics. I've just noticed that all the peoples near the equator that I've ever been around have been pretty miserable. Life in a really hot climate, a hot, wet climate, is not a very joyous thing. And if you look back at sort of the great human achievements...
Well, I mean, the people in Hawaii like it, Peter. You and I might not. I don't particularly enjoy it. All that humidity, you walk outside and, you know, 5 minutes, you've got to have a shower. No, it's not for me and it's not for you, but some seem to enjoy it.
Yeah, but Hawaii is an exception. It's right on the ocean, and there's ocean breezes. I'm talking about places that I've been right on the equator itself. I've been in the jungles of New Guinea, far from any coast. I've been in Palau, far from any coast.
Right.
And it's not Hawaii at all. It's much more miserable.
Wouldn't be my choice.
Well, it strikes me as no coincidence that every equatorial people I've ever met have evolved or produced some sort of hallucinogenic drug to take their mind off things. Everybody has their own betel nut or kava root or ganja. You know, they all have to get high.
Yes. To even live there, huh? And you really think this could happen to what are now the temperate climates?
Yeah, I think so. And we both realize that global warming isn't the greatest danger. The greatest single danger is what was portrayed in that movie, is that global warming then kicks us into glaciation.
Yes.
Global warming will be a great inconvenience, but glaciation is technological disaster.
All right, let's get back to man's hand in this. This is very controversial, and... I'm not exactly sure where I come down, even myself, on the question. Peter, it may be the forces of nature are so profound that man's hand in this is fairly trivial, and what's going to happen is going to happen anyway, but you're the guy with the computer models and so forth and so on, and you can measure how much we're doing, human beings are contributing, so you tell me, how important is man's hand in the ongoing process?
Well, again, we are producing the majority of CO2. That's being done by the Earth itself.
Right.
We're actually putting a minority of it into the atmosphere. But what we're adding to what is already there is just enough to cause it to rise. And the rise, generally, there are a bunch of feedback systems. For instance, when it gets warmer, the Earth has evolved some really fantastic systems to scrub CO2 out of the atmosphere. One of these ways is building coral reefs. If you build calcium carbonate organisms, carbonate systems in such a way, they take carbon dioxide. They need it.
Yeah.
And so when it gets warmer, you build more coral reefs.
But doggone, you know, Peter, I've been hearing these news stories about coral reefs dying. That could be worrisome, couldn't it?
Well, the problem is, too, that if you get past a certain temperature range, they do die.
Yes.
I mean, they have a pretty critical temperature threshold. And what we're doing now is, again, the temperature rises are historic in the rate at which it seems to be going up. And this is what spooks me again, is looking at some of the past mass extinctions. There are about 15 past mass extinctions, and we can only find one of them that's been caused by asteroid impact.
Mm-hmm.
And the other 14 all seem to be related to rapid rise in carbon dioxide.
Do you project this... scenario to the universe in general? In other words, when we're talking about the possibility of alien or intelligent life evolving on another planet somewhere, do you think it unlikely because they go through exactly the same cycles that you're talking to us about us going through right now? In other words, if in another 100 years it's going to look as you've suggested, in 200 years, who knows? I mean, I can see that after a while, we wouldn't have the ability to contact anybody else, much less the will. We might not even be here. So is that what happens on planet after planet after planet, these cycles that eradicate life generally?
Well, I actually just gave a lecture on what causes mass extinctions, and on the PowerPoint that I use, I have right at the bottom the general cause of mass extinction would be the rise of intelligent life. I think anytime life hits intelligence, you get pointed elbows, so to speak, and I think you do dastardly things to your planet. So we're not evil in being alone in this. My suspicion is that every time a species goes from sort of non-technology to technology, a whole lot of other species die at the same time. So I think what we're doing probably isn't unique. In terms of cycles of dying, I don't think we're going to exterminate ourselves. I just think things are going to get miserable.
Miserable. Right. But enough of a cycle that it would depress a planet from the ability to go look for others, or perhaps develop past a certain point. These mass extinctions would stop that, making alien life contacting us all the less possible or probable?
Well, that's a great question. Let's take the scenario from your book and also from the movie. Let's just say that Europe freezes. Let's say global warming takes us into a cold snap and we lose Europe. In a situation where there's 700 million very hungry and well-armed Europeans, will anybody be taking the time to be pointing radio telescopes at stars in space?
No, that was my point.
I don't think so either. I don't think it's a case of civilization collapses. I just think we're going to be sort of thinking about other problems.
Well, such changes would provoke any number of things, Peter. I mean, possibility of wars. And, of course, today, if we have a big war, why, we could, you know, become extinct that way. But a large change, I mean, just imagine the one where Europe freezes. Well, what are they going to do? They're well-armed. They're going to go south and take land they can live on.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
And that's going to be a war. And they, you know, if you get the wrong parties involved in a war, then you've got a nuclear exchange. And then who knows, Peter?
Well, that's the horrifying point of view. And, again, it was always the Cold War and just ideology that put us at risk between we and the Russians, which you and I suffered through all those 40, 50 years of Cold War. And it's funny now that it might be climate that puts us in the same sort of danger.
Yeah, well, I mean, your scenario assumed, then the rest of it seems quite probable, doesn't it?
I hope not. Again, I've got a little 8-year-old boy that's about 30 feet away from me sleeping, and those are sort of areas I just don't want to think about.
Well, you're a scientist, though. You're paid to think about this stuff.
Not this time of night.
So where are we in this process? That's a fair question, I think.
Well, we have the ability to change things. I mean, we really, at this moment, have the technology. What we don't have is the will. We have the ability to clean up the act, and of course it is...
Tell me, how would we do it? I sort of don't believe that, but if you're saying we have the ability to actually change it, then make me a believer. What do we do?
Well, the most important two areas on the planet now that we have to worry about are India and China, because it is sort of the emerging middle class on those two continents, subcontinents, if you will, that are going to dictate the history, the future history of the Earth's atmosphere. We and the Europeans have been spewing stuff up, and the rate of rise has been, obviously, it's measurable, and it's moving in one direction. But if we put two cars in every garage in China and two cars in every garage in India, and at the rate at which their economies are improving, that is certainly a possibility.
You bet.
Then we're now looking at, well, besides $6 or $7 or $8 per gallon gasoline, we're looking at an atmosphere that could very well spiral out of control. So there really has to be soon a realization. First, like any alcoholic, we are sort of gasaholics. We have to say, look, we got a problem, admit there's a problem. And then secondly, start looking at solutions.
I agree with you, but I don't see it happening. Anyway, that said, what could we do, Peter? You said it could be avoided. What would we have to do?
Well, I saw Newsweek 2 weeks ago that they're touting the ability to produce between 100 and 200 miles per gallon cars. Certainly, if you have a hybrid and you combine it with gasoline-alcohol mixtures, you'll really start looking at the ability to do that. And even hybrids and SUVs that are getting 35 or 40 miles per gallon make a gigantic difference. But I heard something, and I was in Portland giving lectures last week, and I heard something that just broke my heart because it showed me that maybe we won't reach for that solution. The state of Oregon has decided that hybrids are endangering its tax base. So instead of a gas tax, they are going to have a mile per...
I heard that, per mile tax, yes.
Per mile tax, so all these hybrids have to pay because, as it is now, they're paying less gas tax than are the SUV people. I couldn't believe it when I heard that.
I can believe it.
Government solutions like that are just going to ensure that we have this global climate crisis.
I remember when there was a water crisis, and... I won't even say where, it doesn't matter. In this giant water crisis, people were asked to please use less water. Well, guess what? They did. In fact, they did such a good job of using so much less water that the water company had to hike the price of water to stay alive. It's exactly the same thing. So, in other words, you get a car that gets very good mileage, and the state will punish you with more tax. Same exact thing, right?
Well, that seems to be what the solution is out here, and the West is the most liberal of the states. So I was quite surprised that Oregon would take that measure, but it was disconcerting, put it that way.
We're talking about money here, Peter.
Yeah, we are.
And, in fact, with the entire process that you and I are talking about, the changeover and using so much less and all the rest, it's all money, Peter. And... always follow the money. And so the possibility of doing what you're suggesting we would have to do to stop our otherwise probable future, it ain't going to happen.
Well, I'm wondering if there's going to be a tipping point. When $3 a gallon gasoline hits us, which I predict will be either late in the driving season this summer or certainly next year.
Agreed.
Is there going to be a psychological tipping point where finally people start saying, my gosh, we really do need to do something, and start pounding on their politicians?
Well, why don't we look at Europe? Europe hit $3 long time ago, and they haven't tipped yet.
Well, Europe's a special case, too, Art, as you know, that most of their governments make the majority of their tax money out of gasoline. And they don't have the income tax systems that we do, so they're taxed, hugely taxed, out of gas taxes. And those cars already are getting twice the mileage as most of ours are. I mean, they drive those little bitty roller skates in France and Spain. There are some big cars, but an awful lot of really efficient cars, too. But those people have been dealing with that for 20 or 30 years. I mean, they're pretty indoctrinated into that, whereas we've subsidized low gasoline for so long that it will be a gigantic political shock to our system when this comes to pass. And
well, see, all right, you're preaching a gigantic economic change that's probably unrealistic. I don't want to be mean to you here, Peter. But
no, that's okay. I'm a pointy head professor.
Yeah, it's probably... not realistic. I too probably do wish that we could do that, but it's not going to happen. So given the fact that probably in our hearts we agree that it's not going to happen, what will?
Probably nothing then.
I've got that. But I mean, China is going to progress as China is progressing, and they're on their way to two cars in every garage. It's going to be not that many years. If you were to, when was the last time? Have you ever been to China?
Yeah, I have.
You have? How long ago?
Last time was probably about 5 or 6 years ago.
All right. I'm talking to people who recently got back from China, Shenzhen and further up, and they say China is changing at a rate that would scare the hell out of anybody who hasn't been there in 5 years.
Yeah, my friends said the same. I had a friend who went who said he wanted to go see all the quaint Chinese riding bicycles.
Yeah.
That didn't exist anymore.
Right.
Oh, boy.
And there are a lot of Chinese. And they're turning into a monstrous industrial nation and a technological nation. And seems like nothing's going to get in the way of that. So being realistic, Peter, this process is going to keep going. And I'm just saying, what do we look forward to? And how soon? 100 years. But, stuff is going to begin happening between now and then. In fact, it's already begun. So I guess I'd like to know the stages. In another 10 or 20 years, most of us can realistically look at least that, what's going to happen?
Well, the scariest point, as you well know, is that if it isn't gasoline that really controls the world and its wealth right now, it's going to be fresh water. And the biggest threat to fresh water is going to be the inevitable rise of sea level. With every meter that sea level goes up in a vertical sense.
Yes.
An awful lot of rivers upriver now have salt injecting into them.
That'd be right.
And the scary part I saw was that the San Joaquin Valley, for instance, is going to have a whole lot more salt injected into it. And that's kind of the California breadbasket. I saw one estimate that something like 20 to 30% of the Earth's crops are formed or at least grown in deltas, and the deltas of the world are going to suffer the most with sea level rise. So if we have even a couple of meters sea level rise, we're going to lose an awful lot of crop growing area.
A lot of these dire predictions, Peter, come from computer modeling, right?
Yeah, they do.
Talk to me about the reliability of computer modeling for climate. How good is it, and or how much error should we expect?
Well, some of it's good and some of it's really bad. And the worst part about climate modeling is that, as I'm told, I don't do this directly, but I have colleagues that do.
Right.
The hardest part is the uppermost atmosphere, the troposphere. The models they have for them just aren't good. I guess that's the best way to say it.
Hmm.
They're certainly better than they were 10 years ago, but we have so little really hard information about what happens between space and the upper atmosphere and what are the effects of clouds on temperature. It's very difficult to make a computer model and put clouds in it. And so those are the areas that people still are scratching their heads. So that's why you get a wide variability in it. And that's why that a lot of people say, gee, we don't have to do anything because we can't really foresee the future.
Well, maybe we can't. I mean, look, they missed the Kilimanjaro thing by 15 years. That's not a minor matter. I mean, that's right on top of us, an event that's supposed to happen within 15 years. But oops, look, it happened now. That seems like a gigantic error.
Yeah, well,
in the very near term, much less trying to forecast the climate in 100 years. Yikes.
I agree. It looks grim. What can you do, Art? We got to show up for work tomorrow.
Oh, absolutely. But... you know, that's why we have scientists like yourself to, you know, I mean, I don't want it sugar-coated for me. I guess I understand the way we're headed, and I don't think that's going to change. And so I want to know what's coming. Most people want to know what's coming, Peter. 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, this in-between time that most of us can relate to because we're going to be here for it.
Just enjoy what we have now, I think, is probably the best lesson to give.
You remind me of Ed Dames.
I don't know.
You know, his predictions get so dire, and then he just gets quiet. John Lear does the same thing. Then they both just say, well, you know, enjoy one day at a time, Art. That's the answer. Don't worry about it. Learn to love the bomb. Enjoy one day at a time.
Well, and we did get through that. You know, there was no Russian Holocaust. So.
All right. Hold on. I'm going to play a love song right in the middle of all of this. A simple love song. From the high desert in the middle of the night, I'm Art Bell. My guest is a scientist, Peter Ward. And the words, well, the words are kind of dire.
Get it in writing with the After Dark newsletter. Subscribe by calling 1-888-727-5505.
I'd like to know.